Right, good morning. So I'm this idea has been on my mind for a while, kind of thinking about what I might talk about today, and when there were not many volunteers to talk today, so I put myself in. As usual, it's not my idea, but I thought it was kind of a useful reflection for us. So I'm going to kind of frame it in terms of these, well, three questions, if you like. What's sin? Kind of done that quite a lot. How does sin affect our relationship with God? And how does God respond to sin? And I'll start with what I think is a common kind of actually misunderstanding that I think a lot of us perhaps have grown up with. I'll then have a brief interlude and then kind of step through Psalm 22 and kind of come back to those questions. So my jumping off point is a familiar passage from Good Friday. So Mark's gospel, as you perhaps know, is probably Peter's account of what happens. And so at noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. At 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing near heard this, they said, "Listen, he's called Elijah." Someone ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on the staff, and offered it to Jesus to drink. "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down," he said. And with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. So the thing I want us to think about is that particular bit where Peter recalls and Matthew repeats it, where Jesus says from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And this is, I think, in some ways, quite often used as a sort of a key verse in a certain understanding of Jesus and the cross and sin. And it's that understanding that we've talked about on and off, where we think about sin mainly as moral failure, bad things, and then the argument goes, well, how does sin affect our relationship with God? That bad stuff cuts us off from God. And how does God respond to sin? God, so holy, God can't or won't look at sin. Perhaps God judges and punishes sin. And, how do we know that? Well, it's an idea that does crop up in the Bible, but arguably this is one of the key verses that people would turn to and say, look, even Jesus says, as all this stuff he's carrying on Good Friday is such that even God turns aside from Jesus. Isn't that a pretty conclusive proof? And then it's, there's a song that sort of riffs on that, talks about the Father turns his face away. So that's actually what I want to take issue with this morning. And so the question is, what's going on? What's happening there? My God, why have you forsaken me? If you read the little footnote in the Bible, it says this is Psalm 22, verse 1. So Jesus is directly quoting from Psalm 22, which is why we'll look at Psalm 22. And the question is that a statement of doctrine? Is Jesus saying, this is what happened, this is what's happening now, or is it something else? And I'm going to suggest it's something else. So it struck me this is a fantastic opportunity to share with you one of my heirloom quality dad jokes. I forget the precise setting, but for the sake of argument, let's assume it's the Wild West. There's this lone traveller, and he encounters this group of drovers and their wagons and cattle, and they invite him to join them to travel. So that evening, around the fire, as they're eating their beans, one of the drovers suddenly calls out, "Number 12!" And all the other drovers burst into laughter. And the guy's very puzzled. A few moments later, another one called out, "Number 15!" And again, they burst into laughter. So he turns to the driver next to him and says, "What's going on?" He said, "Well, we've been travelling together for so long that everyone knows everyone else's jokes. And so we don't actually have to tell the jokes anymore. We just say which joke number it is. And everyone remembers and can laugh." And indeed, it carries on. And they call it, "Number 18. So you think, "Well, this can't be too difficult, can it? Perhaps I'll give it a go." So after a little while, he plucks up his courage. He says, "Number 7. And there's just nothing, absolutely flat. So he turns to the driver next to him and says, "What's wrong? Is number 7 not very funny?" He said, "No, number 7's a fantastic joke. Problem is the way you tell them." So the point of that really is to say, I think what Jesus is doing there, where he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Is effectively, he shouts Psalm 22. You know, that's what's going on. He's not saying this particular line is the thing that I'm getting at, but it's the whole of that psalm is what Jesus is calling attention to from the cross. And as we've been looking at through this series, the psalms are the prayers and the hymns, the songbook of the Jewish people. And so, you know, everyone, every Jew there would have known verbatim Psalm 22 and indeed all of the psalms. And you know, so that would immediately call it to mind. And as we've said before, you know, they're songs, they're meant to be memorable, they're used in community, and they're things that come from the heart. They're prayers not about doctrine, about facts about God, but they're about people's experiences, the experiences of the people of Israel, and they're relating to God. So why Psalm 22? We know we'll step through it and we'll see there's a lot of resonances. So, you know, maybe some of those things that are going on are bringing it to mind for Jesus there as he's on the cross. Maybe, I don't know, what was he doing on the Mount of Olives beforehand? Perhaps this is one of the things he was reflecting on. You know, we don't really know what was going on exactly in his mind. What does it mean to be God and human? That's a difficult question, isn't it? But amongst other things, he's drawn on the resources of the whole Jewish people's history and their scriptures to shape his understanding of who he is in God, as God. So maybe he was meditating on this, and maybe he thinks, you know, this is going to be a useful thing for those who are following me to understand what's going on now. And certainly, you know, in various ones of the Gospels, that you know, the writers call out some of these similarities that we'll see and be reminded of. So, what is Psalm 22? It's a psalm of David, so it's a psalm about David or a psalm by David. And as we'll see, it's David in a difficult place. David in a situation of conflict and perhaps universal opposition. And nobody has any idea what the tune of the Dove of the Morning is, by the way. So it starts, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? So far from the cries, my cries of anguish. My God, I cry out to you by day, but you don't answer. By night, but I find no rest." So that's David's emotional jumping off point, this sense that God is not saving him. He's in this difficult situation of opposition. We don't know exactly when. Is it when, one of the sort of military conflict situations, or is it in conflict with his with Absalom and his faction? We don't know. But here's David's heart cry: this sense that I'm in trouble, and God, you know, I need you to kind of come and do something, and I feel like you've not been responding. You're not responding to me at the moment. "Yet you are enthroned as the Holy One. You are the one Israel praises. In you our ancestors put their trust. They trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried out and were saved. In you they trusted and were not put to shame." So even from that initial starting point of, you know, feeling that God's not responding, David is already reminding himself that God has track record. God has been working, has been faithful to his people, throughout the years, throughout the generations, when people have cried out, God has saved them and they've not been put to shame. But his own situation still feels pretty bad. I'm a worm and not a man, scorned by everyone, despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. And this is one of those places where we do get this really remarkable resonance between David in his situation and what you see with Jesus on the cross. As, you know, again, the onlookers, the Romans, the Jewish authorities literally say to him, okay, we know if God's supporting you, then come let him save you now. Come down. You know, David's feeling that same kind of opposition and oppression from perhaps military or other powers around him, saying, okay, you know, is God going to help you? Well, let him get on with it. Yet you brought me out of the womb. You made me trust in you, even at my mother's breast. From birth I was cast on you. From my mother's womb you've been my God. So again, David comes back and reminds himself. First he was reminding himself of God's faithfulness to Israel. Now he reminds himself of his own history with God. That even from the womb, even from before birth, he's had that consciousness of God, and you know, how much more true must that be of Jesus? David now appeals directly to God. Don't be far from me, for trouble is near and there's no one to help. Many bulls surround me, strong bulls of Bashan encircle me, roaring lions that tear their prey open their mouths wide against me. So, you know, sketching this imaginative picture of, you know, perhaps it's military forces or other kings from the region arranged against him, threatening his rule. And he says, I'm poured out like water and all of my bones are out of joint. My heart's turned to wax, it's melted within me. My mouth's dried up like a potsherd. My tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. You know, so David here, talking about himself, feels that, you know, even in himself, he's coming close to death. I don't know what his physical situation is. There are times in his life when he's been on the run and, you know, out in the sort of Middle Eastern desert. So he has that experience of, you know, being in a dry land, struggling to find water. And again, this sort of strange, if you like, resonance with Jesus on the cross. At one point, he asks for something to drink. You know, is he thinking of this? There's other psalms as well, which have the same sort of image. Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircles me. They pierce my hands and my feet. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment. So, you know, as we look back with these words at Jesus on the cross, we see some, you know, very stark correspondences. I don't suppose David is really thinking about crucifixion. He's probably thinking about something more like the Good Samaritan, you know, the Samaritan, the Jew on the road who's attacked by robbers and he's beaten and he's left for dead at the side of the road. And that's something of how David feels as he's writing that psalm. Unknowingly, I suppose, foreshadowing you know, that sort of stark situation with Jesus on the cross, whether literally to the point of dividing his undergarment by casting lots, as some of the gospel writers point out. You know, this is what's going on. David appeals to God again, but you, Lord, do not be far from me. You're my strength. Come quickly to help me. Deliver me from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dogs. Rescue me from the mouth of the lions and save me from the horns of the wild oxen. So these are the sort of pictures of those opposed against him. So he calls out again that God deliver him. I will declare your name to my people. In your assembly I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, honor him. Revere him, all you descendants of Israel. David calls on the people to acknowledge God as he acknowledges God. You know, as God comes close to him, then David undertakes to respond in praise. For God has not despised or scorned the suffering of the afflicted one. He has not hidden his face from him, but has listened to his cry for help. So again, an expression in the first instance in the psalm of David's confidence that God hears him, God has not turned from him. But equally, I'd like to suggest in relation to Jesus, exactly the same thing is true. God has not turned away from Jesus. Even with, you know, carrying the pain and suffering of the world, God in Jesus is there. I mean, how can God turn away from God? So God has not hidden his face from him. He's listened to his cry for help. And from that, David has confidence in God. From you comes the theme of my praise in the great assembly. Before those who fear you, I will fulfill my vows. The poor will eat and be satisfied, and those who seek the Lord will praise him. May your hearts live forever. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him, for dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. David has confidence in God's future. He sees God's rule at work, and he trusts that even though right now things seem dark, he's opposed and oppressed, that nonetheless all families of nations will bow down before God. There's a future coming when God's rule will be assured. And all the rich of the earth will feast and worship, and all who go down to the dust will kneel before him. Those who cannot keep themselves, posterity will serve him, and future generations will be told about the Lord. They'll proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it. And I think there's no coincidence that that last line of the psalm echoes Jesus saying, it's finished. You know, the conclusion of the psalm is that final confidence in God and what he's doing. And you know, we are those future generations, aren't we? So when Jesus from the cross is recorded as saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? You know, honestly, I don't think it is a statement that he has been forsaken. He's invoking the whole of that psalm, that resonance with the experience of David as a kind of an anchor and a reference point for his own experience and his, for his disciples to understand what's going on. I mean, it's not surprising that he didn't have the breath to recite the whole thing from the cross, because that's kind of the design of the thing. But, you know, pulling out those, some of those real landmarks in that psalm. God has not despised or scorned the suffering of the afflicted one. David, I guess, was thinking about himself, but prophetically also about Jesus. He's not hidden his face from him. He's listened to his cry for help. Future generations proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it. Now, I think those are the more important messages, you know, that declaration carries in the situation of Good Friday. So, to go back to those questions, just to round off, you know, as we've talked about several times, sin isn't about bad things. At the end of the day, sin is about idolatry, about not putting God in the right place, not having God as our reference point. And if you like, the things that we often think about as sin are really just the symptoms. They're not the cause. The cause is, you know, we've lost our connection with God, and as a result, you know, stuff happens. So how does sin affect our relationship with God? Well, by definition, sin is a disrupted, a disordered relationship with God. And that's what it is. You know, it's not that it causes it, but that's what it is. You know, think of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. What's their problem? It's not eating from the tree of good knowledge of good and evil. It's distrust of God. God says, you know, do this, and the snake says, oh, well, I think God's actually trying to cause you a bit of trouble here. And they go, well, yes, maybe he is. You know, so it's the broken relationship, the broken trust that comes first, and then the actions come second. How does God respond to sin? He doesn't turn away from sin. I mean, if he turned away from sin, then why would Jesus be there? You know, the whole message of Christianity is that God comes, God enters this mess in order to deal with it. So God does see and he does hear, and he's always working to restore our relationship. And so in Jesus, as it said in that little video at the beginning, God in Jesus takes all of the pain and the brokenness of the world into himself and carries it through death, destroying its power and making it possible for the new creation to be brought about, for things to be restored. How do we know it? Well, as Peter said in his first sermon, God raised this Jesus to life, and we're all witnesses of it. And therefore, let all Israel be assured, God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Messiah. And as it said in the psalm, God's done it. Or as Jesus said from the cross, it's finished.